So about 8 years ago, I gave a series of talks on Dongshan's five ranks. And today we come to case 38 in the transmission of light, Dongshan's waking up story. And incidentally, a book on those ranks or modes has recently been published by Wisdom Books, written by Ross Bolliter, a friend of Eileen and mine, and a Zen teacher in Australia. Ross is a gifted writer, articulate, and he has a clear and penetrating eye. And so I highly recommend his book. This talk will begin a series of six or seven talks on Dongshan. So he'll be the theme or subject for the Winter Bones 8-day session in September. So Dongshan was born in 807 of our common era, and he died 62 years later. He lived at the same time as Lin Shi and Dai Shan and the great nun Liu Tianmo, who we call forth in our dedication after reciting the Heart Sutra and the Dispelling Misfortune Dharani. Dongshan is considered a founding ancestor of the Soto sect, which takes part of his name, Kao Dong in Chinese, or Soto in Sino-Japanese, from him. In Dogen's 95-chaptered Shobo Genzo, Dogen invites Dongshan into almost a quarter of the chapters. Dogen comments on Dongshan's sayings, dialogues, commentaries, lectures, and public discourses with constant praise and the acknowledgement of Dongshan as a Buddha ancestor of old. He called Dongshan the eminent monk, which was no small thing since Dogen could be quite tough and critical. So I'd like to read you Dogen's words on one of Dongshan's most famous dialogues. This is case 43 from the Blue Cliff Records. A monk asked Dongshan, "When cold and heat visit us, how should we avoid them?" Dongshan said, "Why not go where there is neither heat nor cold?" The monk asked, "Where is there neither heat nor cold?" And Dongshan said, "When it is hot, kill yourself with heat. When it is cold, kill yourself with cold." So Dogen said in his piece, Shunju, which is spring and fall in English, many people all the way up to the present time have discussed the problem set forth in this dialogue. Nowadays, too, people should exert themselves diligently in resolving this problem. The ancestors have invariably investigated this realm, and those who have investigated it were the ancestors. In both India and China, many of the Buddhas of past and present have considered the comprehension of this problem to be the actualizations of one's own face. Actualizing one's own face in terms of this dialogue has been the koan of all Buddhas. So these are mighty words indeed, pointing directly to Dongshan's own heat and cold, and to Dongshan's own heart. When Dongshan was a young boy, he and his tutor were studying the Heart Sutra. When they came to the line, "No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind," the young boy queried his tutor, saying, "I have, and you have eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body. Why does the sutra say that we do not?" The tutor realized the boy's exceptional questioning spirit and referred him with the family's acknowledgement to the path of Zen. Dongshan sat and questioned some of the leading teachers of the day and finally settled with Hun Yen. At Hun Yen's, he asked the same question he had asked his previous teachers. "What kind of person can hear the sermon expounded by non-sentient beings?" Yun Yen answered, "The non-sentient beings are able to hear it, Can you hear it then, teacher? Asked Dongshan. Hunyan replied, if I could hear it, then you would not be able to hear the Dharma that I teach. Why can't I hear it? Asked Dongshan. Hunyan raised his fly whisk and said, can you hear this? Dongshan replied, no. Hunyan said, you can't even hear it when I expound the Dharma. How do you imagine to hear the non-sentient expound? And with this, Dongshan had realization, and he wrote the following verse. How wonderful, the sermon of the non-sentient is miraculous. If we try to hear it with ears, it is difficult to hear. But when we hear it with eyes, we can rightly know it. This more or less is how Cook, Cleary, and William Powell in the Record of Dongshan translated this dialogue. Akin Roshi used the word no mind in place of non-sentient. So what kind of person can hear the sermon of no mind? The being of no mind can hear the sermon of no mind, and so on. I have the sense Akin translated this passage as he did, so we, his students, wouldn't become confused or caught up in the philosophical underpinnings of sentient and non-sentient dharmas. So let me read you William Powell's footnote that accompanies this case. He says, the question of whether non-sentient beings possess Buddha nature and thus by extension are capable of expressing Dharma was a major controversy in early Tang China and grew out of differing interpretations of the Nirvana Sutra, particularly the line, all beings without exception possess Buddha nature. Hui Cheng was a prominent spokesman for the belief that non-sentient beings are included under all beings. On one occasion, he cited the Avatamsaka Sutra. The Buddha's body completely fills the Dharma realm and is manifest to all beings. Often cited in opposition to this is the following passage from the Nirvana Sutra. Such non-sentient things as walls, tile, and stones lack Buddha nature. All else can be said to have Buddha nature. And then it goes on a little bit like that. So this was quite an argument in this particular period of time in the 8th and 9th and into the 10th century in China. So Powell also added two lines to the dialogue. After hearing Hunyan say, you can't even hear it when I expound the Dharma, how do you imagine to hear the non-sentient expound? Dongshan asked him, which sutra is it taught that non-sentients expound the Dharma? Hunyan said, haven't you seen it? In the Amitabha Sutra, it says, water birds, tree groves, all without exception recite the Buddha's name and recite the Dharma. In an earlier dialogue with another teacher, Dongshan was told, haven't you seen it in the Avatamsaka Sutra? It says the earth expounds Dharma, living being expounded throughout the three times. Everything expounds it. So just as the time we're in is radical and somewhat revolutionary regarding Zen and Buddhist practice, so was the 7th to 9th centuries in China. Currently, we have women and men practicing in the same halls together, living together, eating, working, chanting, cooking, and sleeping together. We have many lay teachers, many women teachers, both lay and monastic. We are uncovering discourses in Taisho written by the Daughters of Emptiness, and the Jukai ceremonial document and sutra dedications are including many, until now, unnamed lay men, lay women, and nuns. So it is a ripe time and an exciting time, and probably a time filled with mistaken directions, but also new pathways and roads. We do not yet know what will take seed, root, and grow. And we do not yet know what will deepen and further clarify the great matter of Zen, or what will obfuscate the way we're walking. I remember years ago when Eiken Roshi was asked about the possibilities of success and failure for all that is happening. He remarked that it was an excellent question, and he'd have a better response in 100 years. So in another 75, we may have a little bit of a better sense of things. One thing that I hope survives and flourishes is the way the Diamond Sangha does koan. Someone said koan are the imaginative depiction of reality, the poetic map of a life of religious practice. So the imaginative depiction of reality and the poetic map of a life of religious practice. Without the language of koan, which is also the language of Dogen, we are often left with only a psychological and emotional language which is adequate to a point, but fails in the face of presenting the coincidences of life and death, of light and dark, of being and non-being, and of born and unborn. So at this time in China, Taoism, Confucianism, and Jnana were marrying, and a unique presentational and poetic language was emerging. There also was a move toward communal living and codes to modulate and enhance this one-body style of practice. The forms of practice were still primarily monastic, but the philosophical underpinnings were expanding to the point that even an 8-year-old girl with just one day of practice could open to that which is always right before our eyes. The classical system of India and Southeast Asia professed a hierarchy of attainment based on sex, male over female, and monasticism, monk over lay, and then sentient over insentient. In classical Buddhism, there were classes of beings who unequivocally did not have, nor would ever have, Buddha nature, because their storehouse seeds were forever defiled. As the Mahayana Sutras were being translated into Chinese, a very new and expansive interpretation, more fitting to the Chinese Taoist understanding of reality, began to emerge. The Chinese broadened meanings and were unflinchingly faithful to the notion of non-duality. If reality were indeed non-dual, then nothing could be outside of it or not included. Not Palestinians by Jews or Jews by Palestinians. Not Rwandans by Tutsis or Tutsis by Rwandans. Not Persians by Arabs or Arabs by Persians. Not monk or lay, male or female, boy or girl. Not even sentient or non-sentient. Each and everything rises and falls in the great ocean. There is no shallow or deep, inside or outside, wet or dry. And there is nothing independent, substantial by itself, or separate. Each thing, animate or inanimate, alive or dead, already born or yet to be born, each resides in its own particular, its own specific Dharma position, and expounds the Dharma from that point as only it can. The raised whisk, the dripping of rain from upside down bells, the chortle of a raven. Each one is it. The dead inside a roadside shrine, the flowers on the altar, and the hum of the speaker, each completely stained or marked with the same unborn, undefiled nature. And this nature is not a thing and has no function, and it doesn't increase or decrease. After realizing this, Dongshan wrote, how wonderful to comprehend that non-sentient beings expound the Dharma. It cannot be heard with the ear, but when sound is heard with the eye, then it is understood. Each of us tends to move in the world in a very particular way. Some with a very developed sense of hearing, some through seeing, some kinesthetically and other through feeling or cognition and so on. In the psychotherapy office I work in, we think of the way one tends to approach the world as the overdeveloped or overfunctioning aspect. Because this particular way is normal to that individual, the experiencing function becomes deeply grooved, and the narrative around the experience tends to be channeled or narrowed into an anemic story. It leaves out or misrepresents the full-bloodedness or bloodiness of the event. But when we switch channels, so to speak, thus allowing ourselves to be more vulnerable, very interesting things can emerge. In a sense, to switch channels and be vulnerable is to let yourself not know. Not as a posture or strategy or a position, but as a way of being open-handed, willing to be a supplicant, a learner at the foot of our own unfolding lives. Yet, I'm sure that Dongshan had none of this in mind with his wonderful, wonderful to comprehend that non-sentient beings expound the Dharma. To hear with the eye, to see with the ear. To hear with the eye, to see with the ear is a lovely Zen way to express true freedom or intimacy. When we are completely entangled in reality, when we are fully engaged with each sound, with each taste, and with each smell, the subject, object, and activity fall away. And when we then see, hear, or touch with any part or all parts of our body, this is the freedom of the wooden horse that whinnies. This is the freedom of the stone woman who gives birth. And this is the freedom of riding a jade elephant backwards, chasing a winged dragon deer. It is the super ordinary side of the ordinary world, where the world is pregnant with possibility. This pregnancy is to be unsaddled and to be unbridled and free to range hither and beyond, wandering in the marvelous circle of wonder. When we listen with our ears only, when we look only with our eyes and smell only with our noses, we can miss the discourses, the expounding of Dharma that is constantly being presented. When we listen only with our ears, when we look only with our eyes, we can miss the discourse of wind and rain. We can miss the discourse of stones and rocks. We can miss the expounding of mountains and rivers. But if we can forget ourselves for only a moment, our dominant ways of moving in the world and of approaching the world, and of giving shape to the world, if we can put it all down for only a moment, just one moment, male and female, lay or monastic, sentient and not, if we can put it down for one moment, we'll then meet ourselves in each place we go. We'll meet ourselves in the sound of jet planes. We'll meet ourselves in the sparkle of still unripe blackberries. And we'll meet ourselves in the bitterness of spoiled red wine. Each is the entranceway, the gateway. Each is the bright pearl itself. So that's part one of eight parts. If you'd like to hear the rest, you have to come back in December. I've learned about that from listening to the radio. It's called a tease. So hopefully that was a good tease.